The newly elected British Prime Minister is warning tough decisions lay ahead as he looks to cut public spending and fix the mistakes made by his predecessor. Anger is boiling in the Aqaba West Bank after Israeli forces kill at least six Palestinians in attacks in Nablus and Ramallah. South Korea and the United States warn of North Korea preparing for an imminent nuclear test. This is World News from Tehran with me, your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Britain's new prime minister says that he will try to fix the mess left behind by his predecessor, Liz Truss, and restore faith in politics. Rishi Sunak made the pledge after taking the reins of the crisis-hit country.
But some mistakes were made. Not born of ill will or bad intentions. Quite the opposite, in fact. But mistakes nonetheless. And I have been elected as leader of my party and your Prime Minister in part to fix them.
Sunak also referred to the country's economic crisis and destabilized energy markets. He said he'd place economic stability and confidence at the heart of his government's agenda. Sunak became the new premier after winning the party's leadership contest. Liz Truss was forced to resign over her economic plan, which led to financial chaos. The crisis was triggered by her so-called mini-budget and tax cuts for the richest. Time now for the news review. Mourners have filled the streets of the occupied West Bank city of Nablus to bid farewell to the Palestinians killed by Israeli forces during their latest assaults. The mourners denounced the Tel Aviv regime for its crimes and called for justice as they carried the bodies of the victims. Five Palestinians were fatally shot during a raid in Nablus, while another one was killed in an assault in the city of Ramallah. Palestinian health officials say that around two dozen others were injured during the attack. Some of them are said to be in critical condition. The killings come just days after regime forces assassinated a senior member of the Palestinian resistance group, Lion's Den. Meantime, representatives of the Palestinian factions held an emergency meeting, declaring a mourning period and a strike throughout the besieged Gaza Strip in solidarity with the Nablus victims.
We call on the Palestinian youth in the West Bank and Gaza Strip to mobilize and demonstrate immediately and engage the enemy at all the confrontational fronts in support of our steadfast people in Al-Quds, Nablus, and all of the occupied West Bank.
Khaled al-Batish called on Palestinians living in other countries to mobilize in front of Israeli embassies and denounce the regime's aggression. He also affirmed the right of Palestinians to resist occupation. The statement said that the strike in Gaza will continue until the end of Tuesday. The regime has recently stepped up deadly crackdown across the occupied lines. More than 120 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank so far this year. Now for more information, I'm inviting a couple of our guests. Our correspondent Mona Kendall joining me from Ramallah. Also with me is Wafa Al-Odaini. She's a Palestinian activist and journalist in Gaza City. Good to see you, ladies. So, Mona, tell us, more and more Palestinians are getting killed by Israeli forces, especially in the past few days. So tell us what the Palestinians are going to do about this, what the situation is like as we speak.
Well, we have to say that Ibrahim had threatened to continue killing Palestinian resistance fighters here in the occupied West Bank under the pretext of battling Palestinians. At the same time, say that they would continue to be engaged in the different forms of resistance. We were talking about popular resistance, Palestinians taking part in demonstrations and protests against the Israeli settlement and confiscation of land. What's happening now is all resistance. There is this newly formed Palestinian group, Lion's Den, in Nablus, where thousands of Palestinians had been engaged in the fighting of Israeli forces, part of the Palestinian group Lion Den. What happened, the Lion Den, of course, what happened early Tuesday is that Israeli troops, large numbers of Israeli forces, raided the city of Nablus. There were statements from the Israeli military that they want to arrest or kill or get rid of members of the Lion Den group. Palestinian security forces spotted undercover Israeli units, and the clashes took place. Then Palestinian residents of the Nablus city and Palestinian fighters of the Lions then engaged in the firing that took place in Nablus. At the same time, Israeli troops surrounded a building in Nablus city, saying that it was the headquarters of those Palestinian fighters and this group in Nablus. We are speaking about five Palestinians were killed. At least there is one senior fighter or a leader of this group known as Wadia Hawa. The Israeli prime minister himself said, Yair Lapid, said that the Israeli soldiers succeeded in killing terrorist Hawa, and he was killed in exchange of fire. And he even warned the Palestinians that anyone would be engaged in hurting Israelis should know how it will end. This means they, and he said it was a part of a wider operation against what he described as terrorism.
Okay. Now, Wafad Odeni, let's, given the situation and what's happening to Palestinians, you know, there are words of condemnation, they go on to strikes, they're retaliatory attacks, there are rallies, funerals, and support of Palestinians losing their lives elsewhere. But doesn't it seem that what matters most is not Palestinian unity? That's of the essence. Let's talk about that. And what's the situation like among the Palestinian factions and groups? Are they standing united together?
Yeah, well, firstly, thanks for having me. Regarding the Palestinian unity and their unity against the occupation, actually, Palestinians always prove that they are united against the occupation. And whenever there is attack or assault against any Palestinians, any Palestinian throughout Palestine, everybody move and mobilize, whether they took this, they take the street and support their oppressed people. So, for example, here in Gaza, since day one of the siege imposed on the Gaza Strip, since the first day of imposing the siege on Nablus, indeed, the Palestinians here in Gaza or elsewhere in the West Bank or even in Jerusalem, they follow up exactly what is happening there on the ground in Nablus. So, firstly, here in Gaza, they many times they took the streets and they demonstrate several demonstrations and the protests took place here in Gaza. To support and to support or to call for Palestinians to be united against the occupation and to ask the whole world to stop the brutal occupation from keep committing crimes against Palestinians in Nablus. Today, for example, also there is a strike, a comprehensive strike throughout the Gaza Strip. So because they say that the Palestinian faction, all of the Palestinian factions here in the Gaza Strip, they announced that they are in solidarity with Palestinians in Nablus, and they hailed indeed the heroes and the martyrs who were killed and brutally murdered by the occupation forces. So indeed, sometimes throughout the history, it proves that whenever there is any attack in the Palestinian territories, you feel that all Palestinians throughout Palestine and Diaspora, you feel that they are all united. For example, in 2021, when Palestinian in the occupied West Bank in Al-Quds, in Al-Aqsa Mosque, indeed, So the Palestinians there, they call for Palestinians here in Gaza to revolute, to defend them, to help them resist the occupation, and to help them defending the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Mm-hmm. So that is exactly what happened at that time. So Palestinian resistance here in Gaza, they launched rocket into Israel because they support the Palestinians there in Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Okay. So Wafa, are you saying that Palestinians have been caring about other Palestinians there? And fellow Muslim brothers and sisters, because the international community is just watching idle by, the Europe and claimants of human rights, the West, America, they're busy with the Ukraine war, they're talking about their living cost of, cost of living crisis, energy bills and all that, they're too busy with that. It looks like the Palestinians never existed on planet Earth. So you're saying that the Palestinians, it's they themselves that need to continue to support one another, right?
Yeah, exactly. Indeed, the Palestinians feel disappointed from the whole world, especially from the international community, because they never support Palestinian right to self-defense. They always say that Israel has the right to self-defense, but they never say that Palestinians have the right to self-defense. So because they feel disappointed from the whole world, they have to act by themselves. They have to mobilize. They have to use all the ways possible in order to defend their lands, to defend their people. So that's why we can see that the Palestinians, they sometimes use a stabbing operation and sometimes shooting out operations. And here in Gaza, they fire homemade rockets in order to defend their land, to defend their occupied land. And indeed, the Palestinians, they try by all means to defend and to protect their people from the oppression and the brutality that the Palestinians are being subjected to. It becomes like a daily basis from the Israeli occupation.
Okay, I appreciate that. Mona Kandil and Ramallah Wafalodani in Gaza City. South Korea is saying that the North has completed preparations for its first nuclear tests since 2017.
Not only has North Korea openly announced its intentions to preemptively use nuclear weapons, it appears that preparations for a seventh nuclear test have already been completed.
The South Korean president also slammed Pyongyang's recent ballistic missile tests, describing them as a frontal attack on the international community. Yoon also promised to ramp up cooperation with the U.S. to counter North Korea's missile and nuclear deployment programs. Washington also echoed Seoul on a likely test by the North. It says it's ready to face any threat posed by Pyongyang. The latest development comes amid a flurry of missile launches as well as muscle flexing on the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang has test fired several missiles over the past weeks, that in reaction to joint military drills by South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. The North calls those drills a rehearsal for invasion. Now, China has blasted the U.S. for fabricating lies against the country. That after Washington accused Beijing of interfering with its justice system.
I'm not aware of the specific circumstances of the relevant cases. I would like to emphasize that China has always asked its citizens to obey the laws and regulations of the countries they are in. Some people in U.S. law enforcement have a Cold War zero-sum mentality and ideological bias, and have repeatedly fabricated all sorts of excuses and lies to smear China and irrationally suppress Chinese businesses. They have openly provided shelter for Chinese fugitives and obstructed China's efforts to chase them down, turning the U.S. into a safe haven for the corrupt and for lawbreakers.
Now, Wenbin says the allegations undermine the U.S.-China law enforcement collaboration and damage the U.S. side's own image. He added that Beijing will continue to protect the legitimate rights and interests of Chinese citizens. The U.S. Justice Department has charged 13 Chinese nationals for working to try to advance Chinese interests illegally. Two of them are detained. They're facing charges of trying to obstruct a probe into the operations of Chinese technology giant Huawei. Washington says that those charged try to harass Chinese dissidents inside the U.S. and pressured U.S. academics to work for them. Russia has doubled down on the claim that Ukraine is planning to use a so-called dirty bomb in the war, warning it's dangerous to dismiss Moscow's position in the issue. In a press briefing, Kremlin spokesman Dmytro Peskov called the West's stance, quote, a foolish approach given the gravity of the situation. The warning was made as the alleged conventional explosive device laced with toxic nuclear material has turned into a new focus of tensions between the West and Russia. NATO has rejected Moscow's allegations that Ukraine could detonate such bomb. Meantime, the U.S. said that Russia already has a record of mirror imaging where it accuses Ukraine and others of what is planning itself. Moscow has warned that Kyiv has almost completed the building of their bomb. The Kremlin said earlier that Russia planned to raise the issue at the UN Security Council on Tuesday. The waterlogged streets, toppled trees, and evacuated homes, that's the picture in large parts of Bangladesh as a cyclone is hammering the country with howling winds and heavy rains. 16 people have been confirmed dead due to cyclone Sitrang that made landfall on Monday. Authorities say, however, they are yet to get a full grasp of the casualties and damage. The cyclone has generated winds of up to 88 kilometers per hour. It's snapped power and communications and led to evacuations in coastal areas. The extreme weather condition has also triggered warnings to 33,000 Rohingya refugees settled on a flooding-prone island in the Sea of Bengal to stay indoors. And that after the cyclone also affected the nearby Indian state of West Bengal. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Leaders meeting with group of academic elites. On Wednesday, 19th of October 2022, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyidali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of highly talented young scientists and outstanding academics of Iran. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. On Wednesday, 19th of October, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyidali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of highly talented young scientists and academic elites. It should be noted that before the triumph of the Islamic Revolution, there were no outstanding world-class Iranian scientists and academics. But in 2016, according to the well-respected Web of Science website, there were 208 outstanding Iranian scientists and academics who were among the top 1% of world scientists. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, who has given his full backing to the growth of young scientific talent in Iran, having played a central role in establishment of various scientific and research institutions in the country, expressed his joy and gratitude that such a meeting has been arranged. The leader said, "I'm deeply, deeply thankful of Almighty God for allowing this joyful, lively and hope-inspiring meeting to take place once again, now that the coronavirus problem has been largely resolved." Indeed, the presence of you young people, especially young talented academics, generates hope. Your presence, wherever that may be, creates hope, and that is very important. The leader added, "I want to mention two or three points about who the elite are and what they do, and what do we expect from the country's academic elite." Regarding the scientific elite and the elite in general, first of all, we must know, I strongly believe that we should all know this, the scientific elite are one of the country's most precious assets. Yes, the country's natural resources are important. The geographical location and climatic conditions are also very important. All of these are important, but the existence of these scientific elites is one of the country's most important assets. The elite should be considered a great asset. Once we consider them a great asset, that is when we will try to produce more of them and will consider it harmful to lose them. We will treat them with benevolence. Once we understand that they are a great and important asset for the country, our behaviour towards them will be shaped accordingly. In further remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution added, "The scientific elite, and basically the universities, are among the pillars of progress for this country. That is, universities are one of the most important pillars for the country's progress, and the main constituents of the universities are the scientific elite, the highly talented young scientists. The reason you see that, on different occasions, not just yesterday or the day before, attempts have been made to shut down universities or cancel classes so that students and professors won't go to classes is due to the fact that universities play a fundamental role in Iran's progress." Ayatollah Khamenei poignantly added, "I say this forthrightly and with courage. There is no doubt about it. With the triumph of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the needed infrastructure and background for development and growth of highly talented and outstanding young academics and scientists became available." In further remarks, the leader said, "Those who oppose the Islamic Republic cannot bear to see Iran progressing in science and technology and often deny Iran's scientific and technological advancement by prevarication, lies, and attempting to portray everything upside down." Ayatollah Khamenei added, "Universities are one of the greatest obstacles that stand in the way of the arrogant powers. We need to realize that the goal of the world's aggressors is to dominate. By what means? One day they use weapons, another day they use deception, and the next day they use science. They also dominate using science. Universities prevent their domination. This means that if you can raise the scientific status of the country, you are creating a real impediment, a real barrier to domination by the enemy. So that's another important point about academic elite and universities." In further remarks, the leader said, Another point to note is that one element in creating the academic elite is their natural talent, good thought, good mind, good brain, which are all divine gifts. This is not someone's doing, rather it is God-given. Now, why God has given these people this talent is a whole different topic for discussion. The Almighty God has blessed this academic elite of ours with a powerful brain, a good mind, preparedness and alertness, and that's one element. The second element that makes someone an academic elite is their endeavour, their efforts and hard work. Otherwise, there are plenty of people who have this God-given gift, but they don't work, they don't put in any effort, and they don't strive, and they don't get anywhere. They have no self-growth, and they don't help the country either. We have had plenty of these people, we'll still have them, and there were even more of them in the past. So the second element that is required for creating an academic elite is related to their effort and perseverance. Turning to flourishing and spreading of universities in Iran, the leader said, "Which part of the country have you seen where there isn't a university? Now some complain that universities have been established in some places without the necessary facilities. Very well, so the motivation to establish a university was there, that's very important. There are universities all over the country. The universities in some remote cities are outstanding. A person can see this. They have very good lecturers, distinguished professors lecturing at universities in certain remote cities. We know some of them. So that is about spread of universities. And there are the academics. The number of academics, both students and professors, has increased. The number of students in the country, now I have mentioned these statistics many times before, but I don't remember it exactly right now. The sources weren't available to me when I was writing down these notes. There has been a 25-fold increase in the number of students in the Islamic Republic of Iran, a 25-fold increase compared to pre-revolutionary levels is very high. Lecturers in the first years after the revolution, around 1980 or 1981, when I was discussing issues related to universities, there were about 5,000 faculty members in the country as a whole. Today, there are well over 100,000 faculty members. There are over 100,000 faculty members. The country's population has more than doubled in this period of time. But the increase in faculty members has been astounding 20-fold. These are important matters. These statistics speak for themselves. And this clearly shows what the Islamic Revolution has accomplished. There is, of course, a multitude of research institutes in the country, think tanks and research institutes. They're abundant in many parts of the country. The scientific development we're seeing in the country is something that is really valuable. It is part of the groundwork that is needed for nurturing the elite, the highly talented young scientists and engineers. We should truly appreciate the academics. Our academics have not allowed the country to become dependent on the West. Because when a country has universities but no professors, one of the things that comes to mind is to get professors from outside of the country. But our academics did not allow this to happen. They trained people to become professors instead. Around 90% of Iranian professors today have come from the generation that was trained by our own university professors. They worked hard and put in the effort. The Islamic Republic wanted to expand its universities and make them powerful, and thankfully this has happened today. Universities also took advantage of this historical opportunity and developed themselves. And this is one issue. Another issue is that it is not an exaggeration when I say that the academic elites of the country have become a source of honour for the Islamic Republic of Iran. You are the young generation of elites. There were many elites before you, the generations before you, who brought honour to this country during the past 40 years. Whatever issue our scientists encountered and focused on, they did something that garnered admiration within the world's scientific community. For example, the research and achievements of Royan Research Institute, not just regarding stem cell research, but also in cloning of live animals. This was something rare in the world, but it happened here in the Islamic Republic. I saw those living animals myself. I am not narrating from others. I went and saw the living animals that had been cloned and created, and there wasn't just one, there were quite a few of them. We have seen these things happen. It was not a small task. May God's mercy be upon the soul of Professor Kazemi Ashtiani, and he was the one who laid the foundation for this, and then our brothers, who are there now, pursued it and have reached this stage now. That's one example. Advancements in biochemistry and achieving a UNESCO chair in biochemistry, they have admitted it themselves. You know that in these international chairs, one of the basic tasks of the enemy is to interfere, infiltrate, and prevent Iran from getting a seat and becoming a member state. Despite this, our outstanding scientists and elites have achieved this victory. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei continued by saying, "Another example is that we've sent satellites into space. Only a few countries have done this. Not all countries have this technology. A lot of countries have satellites in space, but they are incapable of launching the satellites themselves. There are only a few countries that have launched satellites into space. Of course, we are behind, but we launched these satellites. We were able to do it. Our scientists concentrated on this, and now one of our brothers here mentioned that these things have been achieved in the field of space and aerospace research. For example, building a humanoid robot at Tehran University is also very important and a great achievement. Fundamental achievements in the nuclear industry, the issue of peaceful nuclear technology, has a long story. There is a lot to be said in this regard, but our time is limited. We have gained access to fundamental issues in nuclear industry. We are not seeking weapons or bombs or anything like that, but this industry itself has many benefits, and we were able to gain access to peaceful civilian nuclear technology." Well, these are the things that the Iranian academic elite have accomplished. These things are truly a source of honour for the country. Another example is the production of complex vaccines, including the COVID-19 vaccine and the like. There are many examples, that's another point, that the Iranian elite and scientists have been able to provide the country with honour. I'm saying these things because I want you all, the academic elite, the highly young, talented elite, to appreciate yourselves. I want those sitting outside to appreciate you. I personally have great appreciation for you, and I hope that we will be able to help you in the future. As for the third element, I already spoke about two other elements. This third element now, that makes you an academic elite, that makes you become an elite, is the element of divine guidance and assistance from the Almighty. Without a doubt, you need God to pave the way for you and provide you with divine guidance in order to become, to be considered an elite. Merely having talent and using this talent doesn't make someone into an academic elite. Another point is that our academic elite should be shown bright horizons. Some people make our elite lose hope and paint a dark future for them. That is certainly not the case. The horizon for young, highly talented Iranian scientists and engineers is very bright indeed. This should be known by all of you, and you should all be encouraged. Professors, higher education managers and media, whether it be the state media or the press, and owners of knowledge-based industries and companies, as some of you have also mentioned, should create an encouraging atmosphere for the academic elite. Today, discouraging the elite, making them lose their hope in the future, is, in my opinion, the enemy's soft war strategy against the Islamic Republic. The enemy is striving to show a bleak future for our elite. Now, I should also add that the country does have its weak points. I'm not denying this. There is not only a few, but many weak points. However, we need to see the strengths alongside the weaknesses. The enemy strives to magnify the weaknesses and cover up our strengths, and we should not help the enemy in this regard. And this is the last thing that I would like to speak about. I will talk about this horizon and how we can correct it. Since the beginning of the Islamic Revolution, the West has waged a propaganda campaign against Iran, in which they claim that the Islamic Republic is declining. They would say it was declining from the very first days. Sometimes they would say that the Islamic Republic will be finished in 2 months' time, or in 1 year's time, or in 5 years from now, and they would set specific dates. Some people inside the country also promote these claims, either out of neglect or with malevolent intentions. After the founder of the Islamic Republic, the late Imam Khomeini, passed away in 1989, there were a number of people, among whom there were some well-regarded and experienced individuals, who made declarations about how the government is on the edge of an abyss. They tried to imply that the government would collapse any day now. That was back in 1989. In 2003, a number of parliamentarians wrote a letter to me. It was really an unfair letter. Very unfair. They said some things and they asked some questions that they had to answer themselves. Because both the parliament and the government at the time were in their hands. They needed to answer those questions, but they were demanding answers from me. In summary, the letter stated that you need to surrender, otherwise you'll be finished. That was back in 2003. We did not surrender, of course. We stood up to them, and God willing, we shall continue to do the same. Our enemies have kept doing this repeatedly. The thing that we should look at this context is to see what our analysis of the situation is. Let's conduct a proper analysis. There are two analytical systems that exist. One analytical system believes that standing up to the widespread global norms is useless and there's no point in doing it. They say that there are international norms and governments who have formed and have gained power based on these norms. The powerful and wealthy United States has been shaped according to these norms. Europe is the same. Other countries are the same. Don't waste your time standing up to these norms. You'll be destroyed. That's one kind of analysis. The second type of analysis is more realistic. This type of analysis sees the reality, not just the good facts, but the bad facts as well. I have never denied the weaknesses. In the meetings that I have with officials, in the Ramadan gatherings, I point out the weaknesses more than anything else, and I do so much more in our private meetings. We pay attention to the weaknesses. It's not that we do not notice them. I have said many times before that we are behind, there is no doubt in that. But on the other hand, we started a rapid movement from the end of the line and now we are almost at the front of science and technology. And this is an excellent and an inspiring fact. Look at where the Islamic Republic was 40 years ago and where it is now today. Look at where it was 20 years ago and where it is now today. After 4 decades, we can understand which of these two analyses has been realistic.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Cultivating an Islamic identity in a postmodern world has been our topic tonight. I want to look at the components of an Islamic identity. What comprises of an Islamic identity? Because last night, one thing that I left with all of you was that Islam absolutely has its own identity. Now, when somebody asks you, for example, who you are, what you are, what you do, the answer you give depends on the person who's asking, correct? For example, if somebody is to, in a job interview, if they are to ask you, tell me a little bit about yourself, you'll tell them about your educational path, your work experience, possibly a little bit of your goals. If a potential marriage proposal or a potential spouse now is asking you about yourself, you'll tell them about your family life, your spiritual life, your habits, your likes and dislikes. If somebody on a plane beside you now is asking you a little bit about yourself, a random stranger, again, you'll talk about where you've traveled, how many kids you have. The point is that this idea of the identity is not brought down to one specific set of characteristics. They fluctuate. And all of it now is within the Islamic identity. Now, one component that is very essential that I want to speak a little bit about tonight is the I-ness inside of us. Essentially, what the identity crisis answers is the who-ness inside of us, not the what-ness inside of us. It's not what you are, it's who you are. As I mentioned last night to you, all of you, that when you do end up identifying who you are, you have automatic pride in who you are. And you work hard to preserve that. You seek out those means to strengthen that. You do everything in your power now to make sure that nobody comes and weakens the who inside of you. So Islam now wants you to have that sense of pride inside of you. Allah says, I've honored you. وَلَقَدْ كَرَمْنَا بَنِي آدَمَ I've honored you. I've given you the best of the risk. I've allowed you to travel from the land to the sea. I've made you afzal and distinct over every other creation of mine. So you can have this sense of inner pride. Identify with this path and look to preserve that path. And so tonight, what I want to talk a little bit about tonight and tomorrow, that is a little bit of the I-ness inside of me. Let's bring the point home now. In the world of theology, in this discussion on Ma'ad and life after death, Marhum Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi Rahmatullah Ali, a big scholar in Qum, he has a book called Theological Instructions, Amuzisha Aqaid. It's taught in the Hawza. First year, second year, sort of Aqaid Kalami discussions. 60 discussions about, roughly. In there, he talks about this idea of Ruh al-Mujarrad, immaterial nature of the soul. Okay? He gives a very beautiful example. He says that I want you to imagine, and I'll use present day sort of lingo to kind of bring the point home. So I want you to imagine that, you know, or not imagine, this is a reality for all of us, that we were born a certain way. If I was, let's say, for example, to see some of your baby pictures, I may not recognize that that's you. As you get older now, you begin to resemble less what you looked like when you were 5 or 6 years old. So you come out of your mother's womb now, you're a newborn baby, you look a certain way, and as you know, any of you who have newborn babies, you know, literally within a day or a week or 2 weeks, it's a completely different face altogether, right? It's ever changing. So a six-month-old baby, that same baby turns 3 years old, then turns 10 years old, then turns 15 years old, then turns 21. All throughout their physical journey, they're constantly changing their physical traits. There was a time where I had a full set of hair. Masayib started early, ya Allah. The time where this beard was nice and black. My beard was a nice chin strap, as you guys call it. If I show you my picture when I was 14, 15 years old, you wouldn't recognize me. Still good looking, but a little bit less than today. Oh, you caught that late, yes. The point is that there is constant change in the physical. But one unifying factor is you. If you were to line up all your pictures, this is me when I was 6 months old, Asad Bhai. This is me when I was starting school at 5. This is me in first year in grade 9 when I was, 14 years old. In university, 18 years old. My marriage at 24. My first child, 25. You line up 10 pictures of yourself, all of them are completely different sometimes. Unrecognizable. That's you, Dada. That's you, Nana. Yeah, that's me when I was 15. I couldn't believe it. But the one unifying factor in all of these is Dada. It's not like it's Asad Jafri version 1, Asad Jafri 2.0 or 8.6. No, it's Asad, 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 Asad all throughout. That unifying factor is the I inside of you, which has no physical resemblance. Ruh, that I, is that immaterial soul inside of you. Now, a person's identity, this is a point where it's very crucial now. A person's identity cannot be in a constant state of flux. It's not like you're someone else today and then you're going to be someone else tomorrow. No. Yes, our traits change. You become taller, you become shorter, you become wider, you become this and that, for sure, whatever, this and that. That's different. But who you are does not go through the drastic fluctuation that the physical body goes through. Understand that point. I really hope I got that point across. The different pictures in front of me cannot be this fluctuation of the identity. It's the physical nature of ourself. But what is outside the realm of physical change is the immaterial I that is seen in every single picture. It's that immaterial I that Islam says that is your identity. That's who you are. Because while this physical body of yours will help to elevate the I inside of you, it ultimately is nothing but a tool. They'll be buried one day, and that will be, it'll be powder in the grave, and you being the I will move on to your next world. We have a whole discussion on the idea that even if the next world is jismi, and it is jismi as well, there is a physical component to the next world as well, it won't be this jism in this body. There'll be another body given to us in the hereafter. That body may not resemble us, but it is us. That I is very important. It's that I that we need to work on. It's that I that will be questioned in the grave. It's the I that we are identifying with. The unifying factor from the moment that I left my mother's womb to today is me. That me is the identity. It's command central. Now, our eyes, our ears, our tongue, our everything now affects the I inside of me. That's why sometimes, I warn my young guys, be careful what you show the eyes. I don't mean to be crude, but sometimes I tell you, the things that we watch online, you end up now spoiling your eyes, especially us men. And we end up living in a fictitious fantasy world. Then when it comes time for us to get married to an actual real woman, not one that's, that's in front of our screen, then we think that all women should look like this on the screen. That woman has gone through 8 filters. And within 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 90 days, I tell you, I have fallen out of love with her. That quickly. I get emails that tell me that, you know what, she's no longer beautiful to me anymore. Like you're the catch of the day, right? All because we do what? Sometimes we really, truly spoil our eyes. We don't understand the effect it has on the eye. We watch these shows, I tell you, that have no business being shown in our homes. And we don't understand the impact it has on the eye inside of us. It slowly corrupts it. So my sisters and my brothers, the first component of the Islamic identity is to capture the eye inside of us. the who-ness inside of us. Who are you is not answered by the color of your eyes or your height or where you were born even. Who you are your values, your morals, your ethics.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur Shakurun Wadud Qayyumun Rauf Saburun Majid صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. Divine leaders must, before anyone else, like trailblazers with the banner in their hands, set out on the path, stand tall and lead the way for others to follow. Prophet Ibrahim says, I am the first to submit. The Quran, Surah 6, verse 163. Before anyone or anything else, he says he is the first to humble himself before his Lord. This is the quality of divine leaders. Divine leaders must be like this, and they are like this. The Prophet was present for all the most important and most dangerous events at the advent of Islam. True, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud was beaten, Khabbab was tortured, and Ammar was tortured as well. but the persecution the Prophet suffered was no less than any of these. In fact, if you compare the situation of these devoted companions to the Prophet himself, you will see the Prophet's task was even more difficult and trying, because as their leader, he was always at the forefront. Faith is one of the most important qualities we find in God's messengers.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Here, faith means to believe in what you say with all of your being. The mark of their faith is that they themselves, before anyone else, set out on the path. That is why the Quran tells us, the messenger has faith in what has been sent down to him from his Lord and all the faithful. The Quran, Surah 2, verse 285. The faithful, those who have been converted by him, those outstanding people who have joined him and are now the loudspeakers for his message, are like him as well. Each has faith in Allah. Each and every one of them believed in Allah. They accepted Allah with all of their being, His angels, His scriptures, the holy books which are from the first to the last in harmony with one another, and His messengers and all of His prophets. The Prophet and his followers believe in all of the prophets because all follow the same path. In this path, the prophets are like camel drivers, guiding the caravan along the way. This was a verse from Sheikh Mahmoud Shabistari's poetry. The prophets are all drivers of a single caravan, guiding the caravan on a single path, leading it to a single destination, with people from all places, all going together towards a single terminus.
Allah, I wanna thank you. Things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.